session number 30304.
Ted, we're at reel 7. Ted, was there an examination at the end of the course?
Yes, I think there was. Yes, all I can say is yes. Yes. I'm pretty sure it covered things like navigation, airmanship, meteorology. Well, I must leave it at that because I can't remember any problems there.
Would you have had a flying test, though, as well with the chief instructor?
Yes. There are two tests. One with the chief flying instructor, Squadron Leader Arthur, and one with the officer I mentioned earlier, the RAF test officer.
What did that entail, the flying test? Would they take you through a series of manoeuvres that you had to
perform? Just... They told you briefly before you went off what they wanted you to do. I don't remember any comments. I just simply say, well, that's okay, and that was it.
So what happened at the end of the course? Was there any procedure, or were you just told to report somewhere else?
Yes, we were told that... we were going to, I'm not sure whether the whole course went, I think we did, to RAF Little Rishington. And all I remember about that is that a lorry came, we all piled in with all our stuff and went off and went across London from Waterloo to Paddington. And we were on the Great Western Line to Worcester. Before we got to Worcester, we got off at Kingham, a place called Kingham, which was the nearest station to Little Rishington in the Cotswolds.
And what was the station there? Was it a...
That was the Service Flying Training School, SFTS. they had Ansons for pilots taking multi-engined aircraft and Harvards for pilots going to single-engine training. And it was about 1,000 feet up on the Cotswolds, not far from Bourton-on-the-Water and Burford.
At that stage, had you been allocated to what type of training you would be doing then?
No, only training on twin-engined aircraft or single-engine. There was no reference further than that as to what would happen in the future.
So had you been allocated to twin aircraft?
Yes. Well, what
was... Multi-engine aircraft.
Yes.
How did the patterning instruction play out at Little Rishington? What was the first kind of section of that?
Well, it was the pattern in any stage... Excuse me. The pattern in any stage of RAF training is much the same, in that obviously we've got to know how to get the aircraft off the ground, the various problems that you may come across, the technique of flying on one engine if one failed, and then that leads into the practices to do with the likely function of the aircraft that you will ultimately be flying, such as practice bombing or gun firing, reconnaissance and so on.
What was the Anson like as an aircraft?
Oh, it's a lovely aircraft to fly. There are a lot of them about, of course, that stage of the war. Indeed, they were still around at the end of the war, but at that time, and the best-known phrase about the Anson is, "Anson is as Anson does," which is a very accurate, a very apt phrase to use, because whatever the Anson was asked to do, it would do it. I consider myself lucky to again have the aircraft that I would have chosen, as compared with the Airspeed Oxford, which was being used at other flying training schools, such as Benson and other surrounding airfields. Most of the SFDS flying stations at that time of the war were around the south and southwest, mainly the south of England, because, of course, the Commonwealth air training scheme hadn't yet become effective. But within the next 12 months, after EFTS, elementary training, most pilots were going to Canada or what was then Rhodesia for SFA training.
And the Ansons, can you give me kind of a thumbnail sketch of the aircraft itself, what it looked like, how it handled, that sort of thing?
It didn't look too good on the ground. It had a very heavy undergear, undercarriage, which was a good thing, of course, for a training aircraft. We were still on a grass field, it's a peculiar undercarriage in a way, in that the strongest support was a large, almost small girder, if you like, of metal, which went back behind the wheels and up into the winding gear inside the aircraft. And the only way you could get the undercarriage up was by the pilot or a member of the air crew winding on a handle near the cockpit, just behind the pilot's seat, to wind this undercarriage up. And it took 160 or 170 turns on the handle, so it was a shared job as much as possible, more often than not shared by any unfortunate person who didn't happen to be flying it. But I mention that because it gives some idea of its rigidity. It was an aircraft designed specifically for its purpose, which was in coastal command, because on each side there was a large window space and observation was very easily done, and there was a table, perhaps two, I think one of them was collapsible, just behind the pilot's area for things like charts, etc. And there was also space for a navigator are just a little behind the pilot's level, but next to him, so that if you count the pilot as number one, the navigator as number two, slightly to the right, and then number three down to the left. For a reconnaissance aircraft, it was quite well designed. And this, of course, was in, I think, 1934, it first went on the drawing board. And it was made by the Avro Aircraft Company. It entered service, I think, in the late 1930s. And most of the reconnaissance aircraft, reconnaissance squadrons, were equipped with it at the beginning of the war, and some were still using it when I reached the Hudson stage. It was a fairly normal shape. It had a single fin and rudder, the usual tailplane with the two elevator attachments, twin-engined, I forget the name of the engine, anyway, they were about 450 horsepower each, a two-prop air screw, that means two blades. And of course, it wasn't long before aircraft were flourishing on three blades more and more, of course, because if you've got the power to drive them, you get more airflow from them. But anyway, the old Anson got round all right on that. Cruising speed was about 100, 110 knots. Incidentally, many people don't seem to realize what a knot is, and even though it's spelt K-N-O-T, it's not quite the same as a piece of string. A knot is actually 6,000, and I think it's 6,080 feet, whereas a mile is 5,280, so that obviously, because we were going to go to, once we did know that we were going to go to Coastal Squadron, we had to start thinking about knots, because the first Ansons that we came across were still in MPH. You had good vision from the cockpit, and sufficient room below to mount a gun if necessary, and it had, I think it was a Bolton Paul turret. Not all of them were equipped in that way, of course, because it depended on the function intended for the particular aircraft. But they were very reliable, very forgiving, easy to land, and were used throughout the war for a number of different duties. In fact, I flew them for a number of different reasons later on. And they carried, I think it was perhaps 1,000 pounds worth of bombs in total. Easy to handle and spacious.
Did it have any vices, would you say?
We weren't told of any vices, not in the way that one is sometimes first of all immediately warned of this is likely to happen, as was in the case of the Hudson. But I can't remember being told of any. And certainly didn't come across any myself, nor did anyone on the course, so far as I know. It was just plain sailing. The only snag was that, of course, at that stage of the war and the influx of so many trainee pilots, particularly as we've mentioned already, from the Volunteer Reserve centres, it was difficult for some airfields to be able to operate functionally. At Little Rishington, being both Anson's coming in and doing circuits and bumps for quite a long time, and Harvard's operating from the same airfield, there would have been problems sooner or later had they not established complementary, no, that's not the word they use, an additional site at the airport for Oxford.
What, a satellite airfield?
Yeah, well, it was at that time. Oh dear, what's the name of it? We had a satellite at Kidlington for the poor old Anson trainees to arrive every other morning by about 8:30, which meant leaving Little Rissington 35 miles away, and at about 7 o'clock each morning, and that, as you will guess, meant a very early rising. This only happened every other day because on alternate days we had the usual lectures. Whilst we were at Kidlington, the ground crew were very hard pressed because obviously they were trying to run two airfields with the strength, the ground strength, airmen, mechanics, engineers, and so on, applicable to one. So we had to learn how to swing the air screws, the propellers, for each other. The first greeting which my little group had was, here we come for our first flight in an Anson. No, you're going to be swinging the propeller on those aircraft there for the morning. You may get some time inside an aircraft in the afternoon, which was quite a salutary thing to do. It was all taken in good part. I mean, at that time, as you might well imagine, everybody was working to the one end, that we should make a success of what was going to be looking like much more of a war than many people thought would happen. So that's how we started with the Anson, which I suppose gave us a little more respect for it and always helped in ensuring that nobody was standing near the air screw, the propeller, when we started up the aircraft. So from there, we went into the normal routine of taxiing, airmanship, etc. This was also still a grass field, so we would be landing, taking off and landing into wind. There's one thing that I should have mentioned earlier in connection with both aircraft we were training on, the and the tiger moth and the Anson, and indeed every aircraft, and that is the pre-flight check, which the pilot is obliged to carry out. And the important thing that I forgot to mention is to check that the pitot head cover is removed before anything further is done inside the aircraft to start up the engines or whatever. Because the pitot head is the little tube which is projecting forward, usually as a front part of the aircraft. You can see it on most aircraft, certainly at this particular time or during the development of aeroplanes, which records the airspeed. And as you can imagine, there's nothing worse than taking off without taking the pitot head cover off and before you fly. And I know of one person who actually did that and had to take off and had to leave the runway without any indication. I don't know how he did it, but I mean in terms of absent-mindedness or whatever, because there was no indication of airspeed, of course, all the way around the circuit. But he got it back on the ground, which was an incredible feat seldom heard of. But that's one of the checks that's so vital, and it applies to all aircraft because it's the pressure of the air in this calibrated tube which is computed into miles per hour or knots, as the case may be, on to the dial inside the aircraft, and which is absolutely essential, obviously, to flying. So that was a grievous error on my part. And it's a bit too late now to go back to it. So anyway, we got in the air having forgotten to do that, which I'm happy to say I never did forget. Because it was always the responsibility of the pilot to accept the aircraft and its condition and so on. I mean, if you were running up the engines and you didn't like the sound of it, you had every right to say, well, no, I don't like that. We better have a look at it. And in those days, well, it's still the case, or what they do in civil aviation, but we had a form known as the 700, Form 700, and you had to at least initial certain parts, and I think, yes, a full signature was necessary on the Form 700 before the mechanic would leave the aircraft, and then it was all yours. So that was to interrupt the initial stages of familiarization. Many of the things that I mentioned in connection with the tiger moth, if you can imagine grouping those things together under one heading, it would come under familiarization, which applied in nearly all cases in learning or in getting used to a new aircraft. Things like checking the engines, making sure you had chocks under the wheels. And in the early stages, taxiing, making sure from a safety point of view whether there were other aircraft here or there or coming in, that the instruments were working correctly. Stick your head out of the window and see that when you pull the stick back, the elevator would work. Check the ailerons, which in the Anson was the first time that I came across which was commonplace in multi-engined aircraft, the steering wheel, as it half a steering wheel on top of a column, so it was no longer the joystick, it was the column on which if you, instead of moving the whole column from now on, you would simply turn the wheel as you would in a car to give a left to work the aileron on the left wing, similarly turn it right to work the aileron on the right wing. Now these are things that of course became normal in the familiarisation for the Anson as for the other aircraft.
How would you taxi the Anson? Because obviously, it would have brakes.
Oh, yes.
It's a different method.
Yes, there was a brake lever, very much like a car lever, a clasp type, which was. I'm not sure now where it was. I think it was on the left. Anyway, there was the normal type of brake. The brakes to the wheels were operated by air pressure. I came to regret this later on when I was flying an Anson on a different station. It wasn't a compressor on the aircraft. The air bottle had to be filled from external sources. So if it got down to a very low level, you could find yourself in the same position as you were with the Tiger Moth, that you didn't have any brakes. However, that was up to the instrument and the airmanship. Taxi a multi-engined aircraft, of course, you have power, whether it's a twin-engined aircraft, four-engined, a multi-engined or what, you had power to the left of the nose of the aircraft, and you had power to the right of the nose of the aircraft. You had the rudder, you have the brake, so that to taxi straightforward, at a determined speed, you would use a certain amount of power and the brake, if necessary. If you wanted to turn the aircraft to the left, then you turn the steering wheel, if I can call it that for simplicity, to the left, and the rudder, and apply as much power as was needed. But of course the power in this case has to come not from the same side as the way you want to turn, because the power from the left engine would only hinder the turn, because it's sending its power back parallel to the body of the air, the four and two line, the forward and rear, let's leave it like that, line of the aircraft. So taxiing to the left, you would apply power to the right engine, because that would give that side more lift and more necessarily lift, because you're still on the ground, but more force on the right, and also to help to keep the elevator in the proper position, and that would get you round. And similarly, the opposite, of course, if you want to go to the right. If you want to turn to the right, it's the left engine you're going to need, not the right engine.